Hey guys, welcome back to Based. I have such a long episode for you today. It's 16 pages long, so we're going to try to move quickly. It's been a busy summer. If you haven't been following, I've relocated to Atlanta, taken a new full-time role with Fee, bought a house, launched a website, and released a new clothing line. So I'm sure Lewis will link those things for you at the bottom of the screen here. If you haven't checked them out yet, please head on over and do so. Also, if you don't follow Lewis yet, be sure to follow him, Lewis Angeles. He's doing so much great stuff for us behind the scenes here, and he's such an integral part of the show. We love him. Make sure you check him out and give him a follow. He's just really incredible. But anyways, while I have been producing episodes of Base throughout the summer, our July episode was sort of a special episode in the series. So it's actually been a minute since I sat down and recorded a full episode. So gotta like warm back up. Last month, I hosted my first guest on the program. As you know, I don't usually have guests on the program. That's not for lack of people asking to come on. I get badgered a lot about that. But that's just not really the format of the show. But when I heard Senator Rand Paul wanted to come on, I obviously had to say yes and make an exception. And I thought, what is the coolest thing I could possibly talk to him about? You know, this is something I've admired for years. And I immediately landed on privacy. If you don't know, Rand Paul is a privacy fanatic, and he made me want to. I used to stay up all night watching him filibuster for 11, 12, 13 hours. He would talk about this subject, and I would just sit there, and we called it standing with Rand. There were a lot of us that would like stay up all night on social media to support him and watch this go down. And I would just cry because it was this powerful image of, you know, a lone senator just really going to bat for us and having nobody backing him up as he really fought the machine on behalf of civil liberties. And I wonder why I'm single. I am such a nerd, but that was what I used to do. So I interviewed him on the topic, and this month we're going to kind of make this a part two to that episode. So go back and watch if you haven't, but we're going to do a more intensive deep dive this month on privacy, which I've been wanting to do for a while. The thing about this episode with privacy is that I'm betting a lot of you aren't really with me yet, or if you are, you're probably kind of lukewarm, because this is like the one civil liberty that when we talk about it, I just think a lot of people's eyes glaze over. They just truly don't get it. You know, they'll even sometimes say like, yeah, it just doesn't bother me that much, or I'm just not that worried about it, which blows my mind because I just don't think people understand its importance or how it connects to all of these other problems in our society. And this is like an actually ever-present problem within politics, right? People end up all the way over here with these massive, big problems that they're facing. And they're like, how did this happen? Oh my God, how did we get here? And it's like, you got here because you kept shrugging your shoulders at these things along the way that you didn't think were a big deal, that were actually huge deals. And now you get this, you know, and they just can't really think ahead. So I've titled this episode, "What's the big deal about privacy?" You know, with those like smart aleck social media font letters, because y'all are going to learn today. Privacy is so important. It's a huge deal. We're going to work backwards on the history of the civil liberty, the reason for its inclusion in our founding documents, its erosion over time, and the repercussions that have stemmed from the violations of it. So let's jump into my very, very long outline. If you followed my political career, my activism, you know that I'm a huge civil liberties buff. It's definitely like my top concern, more than taxes, more than regulations, more than economic policy, all of which I care a lot about. But for me, civil liberties is the peak. And I want to explain what people mean when they say civil liberties, because I recognize for some that's kind of jargon. So let's break it down. Put simply, civil liberties are the freedoms and rights of individuals, also referred to as natural rights. Now, I want to emphasize this because there's a lot of discussion in our society these days about what a right is. You know, you'll hear people say, you have a right to healthcare, or you have a right to housing. No, you don't. No, you don't. You want those things, you need those things, but you don't have a right to them. In order for something to be a right, it must be something that you would have access to without the presence of anyone else, or that you are entitled to before the government has the moral authority to take away your liberties. Real rights cannot be granted to you. They can only be violated. You don't have a right to the products of someone else's labor or to their property. That's a really important distinction. But to protect these natural rights, we in the U.S. have a constitution as well as a Bill of Rights where the founders actually listed the civil liberties that they found most important and most essential to protect. It's worth noting here that we almost didn't have a Bill of Rights, actually. There was sort of the split between the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist over whether or not it was needed. And we covered the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist back in my elections episode of BASE, so I'm not going to go back into them here, but if you need that refresher, that's where you should go. But the Federalists were in one camp, and they believed that the Constitution, which was this document that specified the powers that the newly formed U.S. government held, and they thought it would be sufficient enough at upholding individual liberties. They were kind of like, look, we defined what it can do. It's only allowed to do that, and the government will just stay in its lane, and we don't have to worry about anything else. So the Federalists were kind of morons, obviously. But then the Anti-Federalists were like, not strong enough. We know how government is. They're going to still try to, you know, they're going to take a mile if you give them an inch. So we need to actually go in and create a document that specifically lists what the government cannot do. And they ended up winning out because the states couldn't agree in order to ratify the Constitution without it. So it was drafted. About the Bill of Rights, Thomas Jefferson said, "A Bill of Rights is what the people are entitled to against every government on earth, general or particular, and what no just government should refuse or rest on inference." Those are powerful words because this is an ongoing debate in our society to this day. People often have arguments over whether or not the Bill of Rights applies to non-citizens. And I think it's a really stupid debate that kind of repeats itself every couple of years. It'll come up when we're like torturing people at Guantanamo, when we're talking about immigration, war crimes, the list goes on. And people will try to say that the Constitution only applies to citizens. But the Constitution, and specifically the Bill of Rights, protects the God-given natural rights all humans are born into. These documents merely restrict our government from infringing the natural rights that all people inherit on birth. And so if you think it's fine for our government to violate those God-given natural rights based on a person's citizenship, which is a made-up classification, we're going to have beef. Be consistent. You either believe in natural rights or you don't. Pick a lane. I hope you pick the right one. Moving on, let's go over what those natural rights were that the founders ended up feeling were so essential that they must be listed out as expressly protected. You have free speech, you have freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom to assemble, the freedom to petition, the right to self-defense, due process, legal representation, the right to not be tortured or cruelly and unusually punished, and the right to be secure in one's person and property and not be searched without a specified warrant, also commonly referred to as the right to privacy. Now, these are the civil liberties that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights, which refers to the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Obviously, we have ratified many more amendments since its inception, and some of those things would count as civil liberties too, like equal protection before the law or the right to vote. And then still others are laid out a bit more explicitly in the original Constitution. I've linked more on this in my show notes, but for today and for time's sake, we're honing in on the Fourth Amendment, which deals with property and privacy. And it reads in full, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Kind of a mouthful, so let's break that down. I know that old-fashioned language can be a bit cumbersome. First, you have a right to be secure in your person, your house or your property, your papers, and your effects. These are basic property rights. The government can't take your things, can't violate your personhood, your body. They can't spy on you. They can't sort through your effects on a whim. And to extend this, I'd say, you know, a person has the right to be secure in their body, which also it matters a lot for matters of bodily autonomy, which we talk about a lot. Property rights are null and void if you don't have ownership over your own body. This is so important, and this amendment ensures that that is supposed to be protected from government infringing upon it. Secondly, it says, you are to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. The cops aren't supposed to be able to shake you down, search you without cause, or take your stuff. Now, I know, LOLOL, right? Like civil asset forfeiture, the war on drugs, no-knock warrants, traffic stops, stop and frisk, and a whole bunch of other corrupt police practices have all but voided this clause out. I know. I'm well aware. It's why I'm like straight on my way to anger management classes. Trust me. But that is what the government says was it was supposed to uphold. I'm just telling you what it says, not what has actually happened. It also says warrants shall not be issued without probable cause. And when they are issued, they're to be limited in scope, identifying the exact place or person to be searched and things to be seized. Now, if you've spent any time around the justice system, or I would say the legal system, because it's not just at all, you also know that this is a big fat LOL. This isn't really how we're applying warrants or really operate any anymore at all. But again, we're starting from a place of what our life was supposed to be like here, okay? So work with me. And that's the basics of it. Now, if you've ever taken time to actually go and read our founding documents, you'll probably be surprised at how short they are, how much isn't actually specified. The founders really viewed these documents as a list of rules to restrain the government, not the people. And they expected most things that were not specifically defined there to be sorted out locally because the federal government was supposed to be about this big. Didn't work out that way, but that's how it was supposed to go. So if they did include it, you know they found it super duper important, right? So let's look at why they saw these issues in the Fourth Amendment as so essential to write down in these documents. When it comes to the Fourth Amendment, there is a long history that answers this question. And it's a long history that can actually kind of be summed up as in, like, we did not want to be like Great Britain. We had just escaped them, saw a whole lot of things we didn't want to do, and they pulled a lot from this. Britain had a lot of issues with the whole natural rights of their subjects thing for many, many decades. Some of this began to change with the Magna Carta, but the country's people were still subjected to the use of what they called general warrants, which allowed royal agents to search their homes and seize materials on a whim. The ACLU describes it like this. Prior to the American Revolution, British subjects in the colonies and in England had lived with threats posed by general warrants. Unlike contemporary search warrants, which require probable cause, judicial approval, and limits on the place to be searched and the things to be seized, general warrants gave government agents license to search wherever they pleased, no matter their reasons, with impunity. And because the king's ministers could issue general warrants on their own authority, these devices also opened the door to unchecked executive power. They continue. Under the authority of general warrants, the king's agents used the power to search and seize as a tool of oppression, targeting disfavored religious minorities and political opponents, such as those who published pamphlets criticizing the government. Some even used their powers to settle personal vendettas. Shocker. Now, some of this sounds exactly like the kind of thing taking place in our country right now. Exactly. So if you've never connected the dots between privacy violations and their ultimate outcome of political persecution, free speech violations, and being framed for crimes, this is your wake-up call. The dots go like this, right in a row. They're not hard to connect. Just draw the line. Just like that, okay? In a series of mid-18th century cases, courts in England put a stop to some of this madness, holding that general warrants violated basic principles of English law and were therefore unreasonable. And this is where you get the important legal theory of every man's house is his castle. These courts stress that the very existence of general warrants made everyone vulnerable to the threat of unreasonable searches and seizures. The colonists in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, they had also been subjected to general writs of assistance and the same resultant abuses of power. So they were paying really close attention to these developments. And James Otis, who was a Boston lawyer that popularized the slogan, taxation without representation is tyranny, he denounced general warrants, which British authorities were increasingly using to find smuggled goods on which taxes had not been paid. And in this like very legendary speech, he derided them as the worst instrument of arbitrary power, which placed the liberty of every man in the hands of every petty officer. And his work greatly impacted John Adams and eventually the Bill of Rights. All in all, it is clear that the Fourth Amendment was drafted as a protection against the centuries of abuse our founders witnessed under Great Britain. As one piece of research that I linked in my show notes puts it, this intent is best described as a prioritization of the rights and protections of the individual citizen against the arbitrary abuses of government power. And that's really the gist of our entire Constitution and founding. It is all about trying to find ways to rein in government power and to like build a bulwark around individual liberty. If you picture a scale, you know, you have government on this side and it weighs like 1,000,000 pounds with all of its resources and powers. And then you have the individual person over here who maybe weighs like 150 pounds. So historically, you know, it's gone like this, where the individual just gets totally screwed every time they have to go up against a government. Our founders were trying to pile extra weights on the side of the individual so that they had a fighting chance when they inevitably did have to go up against government power. That's what the Fourth Amendment was about, was really like putting some arsenal on our side to help us defend ourselves. But did it work? And I would say, obviously not. It did not work. I've already detailed a few of the gross modern day violations of our civil liberties, and I have a lot more to say about that later in the episode. But history shows it was actually a pretty slow erosion when it comes to the Fourth Amendment that really began to speed up in the 1970s. So I want to look at a few legal milestones. An important reminder before we dive into them on the way our legal system works, because I don't think a lot of people know this. I didn't know it until I worked in pro bono litigation. But when we're looking at court cases, instead of, you know, judges turning back and looking at the original Constitution and kind of weighing the legality of new laws against it, most people in our system instead look at what they call legal precedent. And that means they're looking at how other judges ruled in previous related cases and largely basing their decisions on that. And that's why when we get a bad court decision, it's a really big deal, because it's like taking a brick away from the foundation of our rights and then giving the next guy better access to removing the brick under it. And it just slowly erodes over time. But for a good chunk of our history, the courts actually did a pretty good job of upholding and even expanding upon the Fourth Amendment. The first major challenge came under the case Boyd versus United States. You had E.A. Boyd and Sons. They had 35 cases of plate glass, whatever that is, seized from them at the Port of New York for not paying import duties. To prove its case, the government forced the company to produce their invoices. Boyd complied, but claimed the order was a form of self-incrimination. The founders argued all along that giving the state arbitrary search power harmed individuals in ways that go far beyond the violation of trespasses, and the Supreme Court agreed with the founders in this case, ruling in 1886 that it is not the breaking of his doors and the rummaging of his drawers that constitutes the essence of the offense. Beautiful writing. But rather, the invasion of his indefeasible right of personal security and the state's unjustified encroachment into the privacies of life. Now, that's based. Love that. So the Bill of Rights kind of seems to be holding the government at bay, at least for, 100 years or so. It's doing okay. But then you get 1924, and we get this case, Hester versus United States. This case occurred during Prohibition and involved a man running away from his moonshine vessels when cops came on his land. The defendant alleged that the two officers trespassed on his property in order to secure evidence against him, but the court held that when the actions of the defendant, namely fleeing from the scene and abandoning these vessels, disclosed the location of the moonshine, their examination of the contents did not constitute a seizure. The judges said the reason for this was simple. The Fourth Amendment's protections do not apply to open fields outside one's home. And this created what is known as the open fields exception to the Fourth Amendment, which to me sounds like the open season on your rights exception to the Fourth Amendment, but that's just my take on it. Now take note that when this was done, it was happening under the name of Prohibition. And it's actually this common theme throughout our history that really the most egregious violations of our rights usually occur under prohibitions of some substance the government has convinced social conservatives is so evil it's worth giving up their rights over. And they just keep falling for it over and over and over. I truly don't know how that lesson hasn't been learned yet, but it hasn't. And this phenomenon is known in politics as the Baptists and the bootleggers. This is still something we refer to. I might have talked about this on base before, I can't remember. But the Baptists in this analogy symbolize the religious right. And these people become convinced that regulation is needed to shield society from some evil, and they partner with the bootleggers to politically achieve it. The bootleggers in this analogy represent the lobbyists, the industry insiders, and the politicians who are seeking regulations for ulterior motives, usually to block competition or gain more power, and they use the Baptists to achieve it. So stop falling for it, for the love of God, please. Because they get really bad things done every time this happens. Now, we could spend all day in the courts on this topic. There are so many bad decisions that eroded this right. But for time's sake, I'm going to speed through a few. You're free to look them up and read in more depth about them. In 1925, the court ruled cars could be searched and seized without a warrant as long as there was probable cause in Carroll versus United States. 2 years later, they expanded that decision to boats under United States versus Lee. In Terry versus Ohio in 1968, which is a big one, the court ruled that it is not unconstitutional for American police to stop and frisk a person they reasonably suspect to be armed and involved in a crime. Specifically, the decision held that it is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures when a police officer stops a suspect on the street and questions him or her, even without probable cause, to arrest, so long as the police officer has a reasonable suspicion that the person has committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime. In 1976, they extended this decision to also include checkpoint searches under United States versus Martinez-Forte. Like, the fact that the courts could issue this ruling with a straight face, it is specifically and precisely what the Fourth Amendment says you cannot do. And they're like, seems to pass the sniff test to us. Go for it. And here we are. And then a smash mouth might say, the bad decisions start coming and they don't stop coming. You'll notice the timing of this coincides exactly with the timing of the war on drugs, your next scary substance. In 1982, the court held in Washington versus Chrisman that the Fourth Amendment did not protect contraband within plain view of an officer. In Illinois versus Gates of 1983, the courts eased the standards for probable cause significantly. In New Jersey versus TLO, the Supreme Court basically said it was fine to search school children without a warrant. In 1988, we get California versus Greenwood, another garbage SCOTUS opinion, pun intended here, because it said that a person's trash was not protected under the Fourth Amendment because throwing it out shows intent to transfer it to a third party. So they can go through your trash. All they want. In 1989, the standards for reasonable suspicion were greatly weakened in United States versus Socolow. The court held that tests seeking to distinguish between searches based on drug courier profiles and those based on ongoing criminal activity create unnecessary difficulty in simple Fourth Amendment concepts. The Terry ruling had established that an agent's right to briefly detain an individual for questioning when reasonable suspicion allows it, but the court in this case held that reasonable suspicion could borrow from drug profiles to arrive at a level meriting detention. In plain language, what that means is that factors like paying with cash or traveling long hours for brief trips could easily now be consistent with the actions of an innocent traveler. We're now considerations law enforcement could basically use to establish reasonable suspicion. And so this is how you get the modern system where cops can literally rob you and do with impunity under civil asset forfeiture. They literally steal more people from robbers do in a given year. Literally, look it up. They do. And they do it by saying, you're traveling where with $2,000 on you? That sounds like something a drug carrier would do. And they take your money. It is just so egregious what is happening. Anyways, and so you see, you know, long before we even get into this modern era of technology, the courts and the police had been working to chip away the protections of the Fourth Amendment for decades. By the time I'm born at the end of 1987, this right is gone. It's been shipped down river a decade and a half ago. And they did it all under the guise of keeping people safe, whether it be under prohibition, the war on drugs, or for cop safety and their role as road pirates. This is how they pushed all this through. These things do not happen overnight. They happen case by case, ruling by ruling, shrug of the shoulder to shrug of the shoulder. And because of it, we now have mass incarceration. Jury trials have all but evaporated. Police plant evidence on people. Civil asset forfeiture, which I just can't bring up enough, continues to run rampant. You have no-knock raids. You have thousands of innocent people in jail. And I'm just scratching the surface here of the corruption and the gross injustice against our basic natural rights. So while it's true that one of these court cases or one of these issues on its face may not sound like a big deal to you, if you don't have the foresight to see where it goes next, will you, for the love of God, sit out politics? Please, please sit it out. Because it is so easy to see how they're going to keep chipping away. It's once you're watching the game, you can predict the next 4 or 5 steps. It's not hard. The turn of the century brings the technological revolution, and now we're really screwed, along with the war on terror. And just as in the past, the government continues to use the need to keep people safe and patriotism as an argument for stripping away the natural rights of individuals. And most people just fall in line. I was there. I remember. I was in like 8th grade when this was going on. And even then I was like, this is fishy. The early aughts have been called The Birth of Big Brother, which is a callback to the book 1984. Rand actually mentioned this book in our interview. So if you haven't read it or it's been a while, it's a good one to go pick up. But the thing is, we went from a country that had severely undermined protections for defendants in the courts to a full-blown surveillance state in under 10 years, largely due to technology, because they now had the capabilities to do a lot of things they previously just could not do. Most people didn't really know how much the Fourth Amendment had legally already been eroded before 9/11, because it mostly only impacted people that society at large does not care about. I'm just being frank. It is always the marginalized and the poor that have their rights violated first, and no one blinks an eye because it hasn't harmed them personally yet. It hasn't harmed them personally yet. Some even suggest when these things first start to happen that those who end up in jail or in prison deserve these governmental violations, which is just supremely ignorant, because injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. If you don't stand up for the rights of other people, you don't deserve to have others stand up for your rights. And honestly, by the time you need them to, they'll probably not be able to. It's a big deal. And that's what happened when 9/11 hit. These violations came for all of us, but people had already been so conditioned to expect it, or they were so scared of terrorism, and or they'd just been like really brainwashed into thinking it was patriotic to burn the Bill of Rights, which was quite the scam. And so there really wasn't much pushback from anyone but libertarians. And those who warned against future problems or abuse under these programs that started to happen at the time were called fringe or conspiracy theorists and even like terrorists, right? There was this whole notion of like, well, if you're so worried about it, what are you hiding? You must be a criminal or a terrorist. What? But that was the narrative. So let's go over some of the things that took place immediately after 9/11. First, you have the Department of Homeland Security that was formed. 22 federal departments were absorbed into it. At the time, this move was portrayed as the largest reorganization of the federal government's responsibility since World War II. Just a massive centralization of power with very little oversight to this day. Like, guys, even W. Bush was very hesitant about giving this Byzantine bureaucracy so much power. And that's saying something because he loves big government, digs it. And he was like, this might be a bit much. Even Madman Dick Cheney, his vice president, even this man believed it gave the government too much power. Never before or since has Dick Cheney been concerned with the government getting too much power. But for this, he was like, oh, I think it's crossing a line. This actually kind of shocked me in my research, but alas, they were convinced and it was formed. So we have it. The agency's roles, as best we can tell, are to prevent and disrupt terrorism, protect the American people, key infrastructure, and resources, and to respond to and recover from incidents that do occur. Now, who knows if any of that actually takes place? They are literally not required to tell us anything and can shut down every question under claims of national security. So we don't know. But under this department, you get gems like the Transportation Security Agency, better known as the TSA, you know, that group that fails 90%+ of its own security test every year, but still gets to search all of your things and grope you in airports without a warrant or any probable cause. And who also like makes you sit in these really long lines where you're actually in the most danger of any point in an airport, where you're just a sitting duck in these long lines because they're so incompetent. It takes them 30-40 minutes to get people to walk through a scanner that doesn't work. It's just unbelievable. I hate the TSA. Anyways, that's for another episode. Over the years, there have been numerous problems when it comes to civil liberties and the DHS. Some pertain to the spying measures they take to identify and deport immigrants. Others relate to the behavior by federal agents during police protests last year, where individuals were seized and held at undisclosed locations by them. And still more revolve around their surveillance of Muslim communities and mosques. All around, not great. Interestingly to me, many on the left are calling for its abolition, and I think that's something we could partner on, because I love to get rid of government. So, AOC, holler at me. I'll work with you on that one. On top of the formation of the DHS are numerous other policy choices that happen around the same time, forming the surveillance state we all now live under. Now, I don't want to give the impression that this is all radically new. The U.S. government has been illegally spying on people for forever. The FBI, CSI, and NSA all date back decades and have been corrupt for a hot minute. They have frequently used their spying as a means to silence political dissent, most notably during the Civil Rights, Cold War, and Vietnam eras. But following 9/11, their surveillance techniques really increase. Much of their expanded power hinges on these annual executive orders that declared a state of national emergency. They began with Bush in 2001, and Obama was happy to continue them under his presidency. Like, to this day, the fact that people think Obama was like this anti-war, pro-civil liberties president, I cannot. He was as big of a warmonger and violator of civil liberties as any Republican. I do not understand how he gets a pass. Anyways, the executive orders are pretty egregious that they're doing, because the presidency was never meant to have this kind of unilateral power. But Congress didn't help. Throughout the early 2000s, both Democrats and Republicans passed a number of legislative monstrosities that empowered and expanded what many now call the deep state. And when they say the deep state, most people mean the intelligence community, which is just utterly rogue. Congress did that while also failing to exercise checks and balances on the office of the presidency. They could have put a stop to all these executive orders, and they didn't. So let's start with the first thing they did that was horrible, which is the Patriot Act. He knew I was going to go there. This bill was passed 6 weeks post 9/11 in what the ACLU calls an overnight revision of the nation's surveillance laws that vastly expanded the government's authority to spy on its own citizens while simultaneously reducing checks and balances on those powers like judicial oversight, public accountability, and the ability to challenge government searches in courts. Awesome. Great. It's important to know that most of what was in this bill was not new. It was actually a long-standing wish list that law enforcement had been trying to pass and failing to get past numerous times until they get this like needed crisis where they can fearmonger people into handing over their civil liberties. And so it was sent straight to the floor with no discussion, no debate, no hearings. That's all the best bills are. And members said they had no time to read it. The Bush administration implied that members who voted against it would be blamed for any further terrorist attacks. Yeah. And so it passes, Avi. The Patriot Act increased the government's ability to spy in four big areas. First, it expanded the government's ability to look at records on an individual's activity being held by third parties. Secondly, it expanded the government's ability to search private property without notice to the owner. Yikes. Third, it expands a narrow exception to the Fourth Amendment that had been created for the collection of foreign intelligence information. And fourth, it expands another Fourth Amendment exception for spying that collects addressing information about the origin and destination of communications as opposed to the content. It also makes it far easier for the authorities to gain access to records of citizens held by a third party. It says the FBI can force anyone at all, including doctors, libraries, bookstores, universities, and internet service providers, to turn over records on their clients or customers. And it allows for secret searches. And under the Patriot Act, the FBI can secretly conduct a physical search or wiretap on American citizens to obtain evidence of crime without proving probable cause, as the Fourth Amendment explicitly requires. I'm so pissed. I have to be honest. Like, I try not to go after boomers too hard here because I don't like generational warfare. But like, good Lord, I cannot believe you guys let this happen. I can't believe you stood by and let it happen. It makes me actually sick. I could talk about the Patriot Act for 10 more minutes, but I need to move on so there's more links in my show. It's so much worse than even what I've summarized here. It's so bad. It is. I don't even have words. I don't have words, at least not ones that won't get me censored. So I'm going to keep going. The next legislative atrocity we need to cover is the FISA Amendment. It passed in 2008, under Obama. The bill significantly modified the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, and it gave sweeping new monitoring powers to the government with little court oversight. A few things this bill does. It legalized mass, untargeted, and unwarranted spying on our international phone calls and emails. It restricted judicial oversight of the surveillance program. FISA courts don't actually know who, what, or where things will actually be monitored when they approve these spying techniques. And the government can actually continue a spying program even after it has been denied by the court. So I don't even know what it's there for. And it provided retroactive immunity to the telecommunications companies for their role in the president's domestic spying programs. Now, the FISA court was actually established under the original bill of the 1970s, and it decides whether to approve wiretaps, data collection, and government requests to monitor suspected terrorists and spies. It's a super secret court that is literally just running rogue. I mean, there's no rules here. Like, the Supreme Court justice gets to appoint people, and they cycle in and out, and like, I mean, we don't even really understand what goes on there. It just lets the FBI spy on people based on God knows what criteria. They don't even know what criteria a lot of the time, it seems. And the FISA Amendment basically just furthered that authority. Now, this court hit the headlines two times in recent memory, once under the revelations of Edward Snowden and once when it became quite apparent that the Obama administration used this entity to spy on Trump. And I'll say allegedly, because it's never been proven. And by proven, I mean the government has not indicted itself. But come on, seriously, sources and show notes. Like, it's very obvious to me that that did go down. And don't think that Trump actually, you know, I haven't gone after him in here in this episode because a lot of this did take place under Bush and Obama, but Trump is awful on this too. I mean, he literally was victimized by some of these policies himself and then folded and signed into law a bill renewing the National Security Agency's warrantless internet surveillance program. Wimp. What a wimp. I've never seen somebody fold so quickly as that man. Like, ugh. Ugh. Anyways. Lastly, we're going to talk about the surveillance program that I just referred to, which is better known as PRISM. PRISM stands for the Protect America Act of 2007. They always have the dumbest names. And this led to the creation of a secret NSA program. It allowed the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to explain in classified documents how the U.S. will collect intelligence on foreigners overseas each year, but does not require specific targets or places to be named. PRISM is the NSA's effort to collect massive amounts of data from internet companies such as email content, search histories, and file transfers tied to potential terrorism or espionage suspects. As the Post reports, once the plan is approved by a federal judge in a secret court, the NSA can require companies like Google and Facebook to send data to the government as long as the requests meet the classified plan's criteria. Now, We would never have even known about PRISM were it not for the only actual patriot in this entire stupid story, which is Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden worked for the NSA, and from everything I've read about him, I get the impression that he was like an idealist. Like, I think he genuinely believed in government and its power to help people, and he really wanted to be a part of that. And so he gets in there, and I think when he discovered what he found throughout the course of his work, it really upended his world and like shook his faith. And he, you know, basically found this massive corruption within his agency and made the decision at the age of only 29 to put his life on the line for his ideas. And he did put his life on the line. He could have been killed for this. I want to be really, really clear here. This isn't a small thing that he did. And these are the same ideas that Americans who believe in our founding of individual liberty all share. And he wanted to alert us to this injustice that was taking place against us. In a note accompanying the first set of documents he provided to The Guardian, he wrote, "I understand that I will be made to suffer for my actions, but I will be satisfied if the Federation of Secret Law, an equal pardon, and irresistible executive powers that rule the world that I love are revealed even for an instant." I love him. He also said that he had a very comfortable life that included a salary of roughly $200,000, a girlfriend with whom he shared a home in Hawaii, and a stable career and family that he loved. And he said, "I'm willing to sacrifice all of that because I can't in good conscience allow the U.S. government to destroy privacy, internet freedom, and basic liberties for people around the world with this massive surveillance machine they're secretly building." So what did he find? Also, pause there. Go read his book. Read his book. It's amazing. You need to read it. The revelations that he found were so serious, he was forced to run for his life, abandon everything he loved, and actually hide in hotel rooms. So I want to dig into what was there. One, the Obama administration enabled the National Security Agency to collect caller information from Verizon through a business records provision of the Patriot Act, established under George Bush. The government ordered Verizon to hand over call information on a daily basis, including the time, location, and duration of the calls. The Bush administration began collecting such information in October of 2001 from AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South. Two, Snowden leaked this secret 41-slide PowerPoint presentation that apparently was being used to train U.S. intelligence personnel. The slides detailed the NSA's involvement in a then-clandestine program called PRISM. The PowerPoint presentation confirmed that the NSA is able to directly access the servers of major U.S. service providers, describing collaboration with tech companies like YouTube, Skype, Google, and Apple. Three, Boundless Informant was a tool that allowed the NSA to compile and track the metadata it collects around the world. Boundless Informant proved that despite assurances to Congress, to the contrary, the NSA does in fact keep track of the surveillance it performs on U.S. citizens. They were lying to Congress about this. Four, the NSA can keep and make use of information inadvertently gathered on U.S. citizens for a period of up to 5 years without a warrant, but only if the information is deemed to be relevant in preventing national security threats or to aid further investigations. So, like, LOL, who's checking? Five, the NSA has secretly been collecting millions of emails and chat contact lists around the world. The newly unveiled program expands on the NSA's reach even beyond the already expansive PRISM and X key score, I think is how you would say that, programs, which gave the government the ability to access nearly all digital communications. At the time, Obama said the NSA's efforts to access digital communications did not apply to people living in the United States, but this proved he was lying. Lying. The NSA had tapped the phones of some 35 world leaders on top of that, including close ally German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who branded the snooping unacceptable between friends. Yeah, like, what are you doing? Seven, the NSA was racing to build a so-called quantum computer that would lead to the ability to break encryptions used to protect everything from banking to medical records. Eight, the NSA collected 200 million text messages a day from around the world. The NSA then used these messages to extract location, information, contact, networks, and credit card details of mobile users. Nine, the NSA and GCHQ had hacked into the network of Gemalto, a Dutch company that manufactured 2 billion SIM cards per year and supplied AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and many other wireless providers. According to The Intercept, the hack would have given the agencies access to billions of unique encryption keys that secure the communications of designated users. And I mean, like, that's a fragment of what he revealed. There were thousands of documents. Again, go read his book. Go read the amazing reporting that Glenn Greenwald did on this when he broke the story. And there are still, like, imbeciles out there to this day. They're like, Edward Snowden's a traitor. No, your government is a traitor. Your government is violating you. He's a hero. He was trying to show you what was happening. Do you not see how far gone this is? Do you not see how they act with impunity against you? Do you not see that the Constitution that's supposed to guard your individual liberties is all but gone? I don't, how deep in the sand can you dig your head? The obtuseness is honestly impressive. Snowden sacrificed himself to tell people the truth and to at least give people a fighting chance, and most people shrugged, or even worse, thought he was the villain. And that was just such a sad time in American history, in my opinion. Again, there's more. There's so much more. I've only scratched the surface of what he revealed and what has continued to come out. Links, links, links all over my show notes. Knock yourself out. So if you're still struggling along and saying, you know, you have nothing to worry about if you have nothing to hide, or some other utterly absurd talking point here, I want to dissuade you of that notion. First, to even have that idea comes from a very coddled, privileged place. You don't even know how absurd you sound, because no matter what we profess to believe in this country, no matter what our laws say or have said, the reality is that many people have always been persecuted here and easily violated by the state. You don't care when it happens to them because you believe they brought it on themselves or something, but it will come for you eventually. I've seen it happen time and time again, you know, most recently with like the January 6th rally. And a lot of these people now find themselves in the clutches of our legal system due to their cell phone data. And they're like aghast. People on the right are like shocked. They're like, oh my God, can you believe how the justice system is treating these people? Yeah, I can. I've been trying to tell you about what was going on inside this system for a hot minute. And it's honestly hard to have sympathy for people like this, because they're often the same ones that cheered the progression of it and ignore these atrocities when they happen to others. I'm not excusing the violations of anyone's civil liberties, because I actually defend people I don't like, unlike many, but you'll find I'm in the minority here. And again, when you don't care about violations against others for decades and even support mechanisms that allow them, you're going to have few defenders when the government comes for you. And they will come for you. If you want to kind of connect the dots a little bit further here, let's look at some modern problems and cases and situations that are all enabled by this history. As I previously mentioned, civil asset forfeiture exists. It's honestly like such a massive thing that's on our books. I can't believe people don't talk about it every day that this happens. It just continues to blow my mind. Again, under this practice, police can not only search you on a whim, thanks to the aforementioned precedent against the Fourth Amendment, they can take your things on just a suspicion. They don't even have to charge you with a crime. It is so unjust. And I know it sounds like I'm exaggerating here. I thought it was crazy when I first heard about it too. I assure you, I'm not. I've spent significant time working on this issue. They just have to say they suspect you of a crime and they can take your cash and property without even charging you. The average seizure is $500 or less, and they mostly do it to poor people because they know they can't afford to go hire an attorney to fight to get their stuff back. And in most states, the police then get to keep that stuff and add it to the value of their budget. And again, they steal more most years from people than burglars do combined. And the road for this was paved with Fourth Amendment violations that people shrugged at. Start here, you get here. Next, let's talk about no-knock warrants. These warrants are usually quite broad, and again, don't require a person to be notified. They often get the location wrong, harm innocent people, and have little evidence to even obtain them in the first place. One horrible example of this is the case of Breonna Taylor, who was murdered by police in Louisville. Cops lied to obtain that warrant to her home, indicating a postal officer had given evidence she was receiving drugs at her house. She was not. There was never any evidence of that. She wasn't involved with drugs at all. She had an ex that was the true target of the cops' investigation, whom she did not appear to have seen in some time. She had a new boyfriend. She'd moved on. But they were using these really corrupt practices still. They broke into her home in the middle of the night. And when her current boyfriend fired in self-defense, as we all would, the maniacs actually shot the building up, hitting even nearby apartments and killing Breonna. Please don't think this can't happen to you. It can happen to you very quickly and very easily. And nothing happens to the cops as a repercussion because of qualified immunity. That's a whole other episode. We also see many cases of cops planting evidence on defendants, lying under oath about evidence, obtaining DNA evidence without warrants. Quick reminder that the misapplication of DNA evidence is responsible in 45% of wrongful convictions. So it's a really big deal that they're getting people's DNA without a warrant. That's a huge deal. It's very easy to get wrongfully convicted these days. And again, the erosion of the Fourth Amendment largely enables that. Police have also worked to partner with cell phone companies to get your information and use it against you in court. In 2018, The Supreme Court issued its much-anticipated opinion in Carpenter versus United States, holding that a warrant is required for police to access cell site location information from a cell phone that detailed the geolocation information generated by a cell phone's communication with cell towers. Until then, they had been tracking you without a warrant and using it to put people in jail and court. And let's be serious, they probably still are. It's not like they listen to these court decisions. We've seen the IRS target political opponents. The list goes on. It's not a question of if these violations impact you, it is a question of when they will catch up to you and impact you. This is the exact circumstance our founders were trying to guard against. It was supposed to be really hard to remove a person's freedoms, to violate their property, to violate their person. It frankly isn't anymore. Benjamin Franklin once said that those who give up liberty for security will get neither, and he was right on the money. We have given up so much of our rights that the founders fought hard to secure for us. And in such a short amount of time, it's really very sad. And we certainly aren't safer for it. Drugs won the war on drugs. The Taliban won the war on terror. We are the losers. And we're at this point in history where we can either learn from these mistakes and work to take our liberties back, or we can kind of remain like these frogs in water that just keeps getting slowly turned up to a boil. We're getting cooked alive. We need a generation to rise up that is absolutely rabid on civil liberties, that won't give an inch. And COVID is providing even more violations in this area and more battlefields to fight within. It is time for us to resist. We have got to rise up, and we have got to quit thinking that there is ever an okay infringement of civil liberties. You have to stand up for everybody's civil liberties all the time. Don't give an inch, okay? That's our episode. Be sure to subscribe. Tell your friends to subscribe. Share the episode. If you want to financially support my work or the show, I have a lot of people asking how they can support the show. Head on over to my website. Again, it's hannahdcox.com. You can become a supporter there. And otherwise, I will see you next month.